In the past decade, modern technology and social media have drastically changed our day-to-day lives. The more time we spend on our smartphones, the more likely we're to see warnings about overcoming our addiction to technology. For some, the solution is abstinence. For John Havens, the solution is to take control over our data. Mr. Havens is a contributor to Mashable, to The Guardian, and The Huffington Post, and his book, Hacking Happiness, is published by Penguin. I'm very pleased that it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And we should point out that in happiness, you have the word, the three letters APP within parentheses to let us know what this is really all about.
Yeah, that's my subtle way of doing that.
We're often left out of the buying and selling of our personal data. And you recommend that we become more involved in the transaction. How can we do that?
Yeah, there's sort of an ennui and a frustration now with sharing data. We've done it for so many years. The main way that I advise in the book is to use something called a personal cloud or personal data vault. And the same logic of how you use, say, like a Dropbox for your files to go up on the cloud, you can start doing that with your personal data.
How do I do that?
Well, there's a couple of ways. There's a company called personal.com. There's another one called reputation.com. And there's actually now a whole series of people joining in something called Respect Network, where you can also do it through them.
So what we're doing there is we're keeping it away from other people. Julia Angwin, ProPublica, was a guest on our show recently to discuss how our personal data attract and how she avoided indiscriminate tracking. She uses false names and things. What data are important to keep private?
Well, mostly there's something called your PII, or personally identifiable information data. And this is sort of like our name, our social security number. But the logic of these personal data vaults is actually more about how you actually make the transactions.
Well, I have to give out my social security number all the time, whether I want to or not. I just recently spoke to the gas company, and they asked for at least the last four digits of my social security number. I couldn't understand why they needed that. We were just trying to arrange for somebody to come and look at the meters.
Yeah, this data bank thing, the reason I like it so much, and it's evolving, it's a nascent industry, is that every single time there's a transaction, you get to set up the types of people you'd like to interact with that data, and it's finite, right? They can't keep using it. That's a big part of the data right now, is that people use it for time, immemorial.
A lot of technology is using augmented reality, where the physical and the virtual world collide. Google Glass, for example. How could this tech start to change our day-to-day lives?
Yeah, so that's literally the lens through which you see the world, right? Meaning glass.
A pun there.
Yeah, there you go. I know we talked about that. I love the puns. But if you put something over your eyes that has the bias of the people who created it, it's not that it's evil per se. It's that you'll see the digital data that's overlaid it. So in terms of how you might be broadcast, maybe I'd see your latest tweet, maybe I'd see your LinkedIn profile, but also you wouldn't necessarily be in control of how that's broadcast to me.
There's facial recognition technology. How would that software, would that improve our global well-being?
I think only when our data is protected, because the logic here is that Facebook sort of set a precedent that online right now our pictures can be, we can be facially tagged. And our faces, our face print is the most, identifiable thing about us.
So you say it's vital that we own our data and control who uses it.
Correct.
Yeah, well, I feel like it's totally out of control. I'm just, I want to do something, and they start asking all of these questions, and then I have to decide whether I'm going to give them all of that information. Sometimes I opt out if I think it's not important enough for me, and other times I have no choice. Or I receive something, I want to have an app, and then I get 12 pages of six-point type, and at the end it says, accept this. I'm not going to read all this that type.
Yeah, this data bank or data vault idea, it's a new paradigm. Right? And the logic is that we shouldn't have to do, I think it's called a contract of adhesion, which basically means after you spend all that time, you're like, fine, take my data. That needs to evolve.
So you say that you ask your friends not to put photos of your kids online, but at the same time, you advocate connecting more through apps and technology?
Yeah, once we have a sense where our data can be protected, we can control who gets it and when. then all this marvelous technology, like through quantified self or all these biosensors, we can start to measure things, not just like our fitness and our health, but things like when I'm with certain people, why am I stressed, at what time, and you can start to get ideas of how to optimize your health and your life.
So you're saying you can use technology to increase your own happiness, in effect?
Yeah, or well-being. I talk a lot in the book about positive psychology, which has this idea of hedonic happiness, which is sort of momentary and ephemeral, kind of mood-based, or long-term intrinsic well-being, and you can improve both with this different technology.
There are apps out there right now like Cardio, which you talk about in the book?
Yeah, I love Cardio. A couple of guys from MIT created this. You point your smartphone after you download it. It was a dollar. I think it might still be a dollar. And you can point it at your face, and it gives your accurate heart rate without actually even having to touch your skin. And it does that by measuring the amount of light in your skin, no matter what skin color you have. And the reason I write about that in the book is a lot of people are used to Fitbit or things they can wear that tells their heart rate. But when you start thinking about the fact that you can see other people's biometric data in that way, it means that someday on a date you might be sitting with someone and be able to register, I wonder if she liked what I just said. Her heart rate just went up.
Gary Steingart wrote a novel recently where apps like that have been developed, including ones just how sexy you are. Women would aim their phone at you and decide that you're a loser and not talk to you. It sounds, at the time, it sounded kind of fun, and now it sounds kind of real.
It's totally real. You know, it's kind of like the high school model, John Hughes comes back, you know. But I think what I'm trying to say to people is, if you don't take a measure of your own life, or if you want your life to count, take account of your life and start using these tools to, you know, understand your happiness and improve it.
My guest is John C. Havens. His book, Hacking Happiness, Why Your Personal Data Counts and How Tracking It Can Change the World. You discuss the economics of happiness. How does that correlate to a country's economy?
Sure. So Robert Kennedy in 1968 gave this famous, what is now called as Beyond GDP speech. And he talked about the nature of the gross domestic product being something that measures value. And what it largely measures, it's not evil, but it largely measures financial things, increase of goods. He says it doesn't measure quality of education and art. So in the same way now, Bhutan in 1972 adopted gross national happiness. These are quantitative and qualitative metrics to measure all these different things about a country and citizens, except just financial measures.
Despite the fact that Bhutan discriminates against one of its large minority groups. But that's a whole other thing. How do they determine what a gross national happiness would be? And has anybody tried to do the same thing in this country?
Yeah. In fact, just today, Fast Company had a great article about the it'll come to me. It's the gross product index. No, the social progress index that a guy from Harvard created that's actually measuring the same types of things like community level of community involvement, education, et cetera. And they have evolved. Prime Minister Cameron has been doing this for the past 3 or 4 years. Also in Brazil, here in the States, in Vermont, Somerville, Santa Monica, a lot of people are saying, how can we measure the quality of a person's life in multiple metrics and spectrums besides just money?
And how is the United States doing? I suspect we're not near the top.
In terms of happiness, no, yeah. We're quite low on most of the different ranges because there's this misconception that the more money you have, the happier you'll get. And of course, depending on the study, most people say that at $70,000, that sort of caps, and you don't get happier over that amount.
Well, a lot of people are concerned about the government's intrusions into our lives. How do you see governments using technology to measure citizen behavior in an effort to improve their lives?
Well, I think these things, especially like in the UK, they're doing some really interesting work with putting a lot of this data online. You can find community-level granular data that people have submitted by a subjective well-being surveys online in Excel spreadsheet format. That transparency, I think, is what people are craving with the government, and that will be something that will be a great tool.
Well, you use recycling as a hypothetical where the government could track your purchases and then fine you for not recycling a plastic bottle.
Yeah, I call that accountability-based influence. And a lot of times people are like, the corporations should be more, you know, accountable and the government. And I say, don't forget, if you start driving like a jerk, you know, through Internet of Things technology, M2M, it's called machine to machine, someone can track the time, date, and where you were a jerk, and that will start to affect who you are and how you're perceived.
Well, I think people would be horrified by the government finding out what they bought and whether they recycled the plastic bottle. Although it could get even more complicated if somebody is out going through your trash and taking out cans and they're not there when the government has expected to find 10 soda cans.
Yeah, fair enough. I use it as an example to say, look at all the wonderful, you know, sometimes I get dystopian to get people to think about this stuff, but my focus is on the positive.
Well, there's a difference between big data and little data, isn't there? And how does that apply here?
Big data is largely a marketing term, because now if you say, like, the power of big data, it's like saying the power of the internet. It's just too wide scope to talk about. Little data usually typically refers to your health data that you get from things like a Fitbit or a Jawbone Up.
You say that social media inhibit exploration of identity. In what way?
Well, I think right now there's a focus on building up influence. And there's a lot of really good services like Clout and Peer Index where you can actually measure how many tweets did I have, how many people retweeted it. And in one sense, that's your influence in terms of how you sound. Do you sound smart? What I try to focus on in the book, again, is this idea of accountability, that as well as what you say, it's what you do that can be tracked in this virtual world.
So are you saying that the more control we have over our data, the more we can use technology to increase our individual and global prosperity?
Yes, because I think once we control that data, then we can feel comfortable about exchanging it with people in new ways. Like, for instance, right now I talk about in the book the example of my kids who are 11 and 8. I hope when they go to college, instead of a credit card company saying, hey, can we give you a $10,000 credit card loan, they actually say, can we pay you $10,000 for the next year to track you in these ways? And they agree on it beforehand, and then my kids may have a closer relationship with that brand, et cetera.
Well, I usually hit don't allow. But the problem is that corporations, government, don't necessarily want us to control our data.
I think that's a huge point that we need to deal with. The fact that they don't want us to deal with it doesn't mean that, say, the data broker industry, which is a multi-billion dollar industry, should not give us even access to see our data. That's why they've been sanctioned by the FTC.
You write that, and I'm quoting, we'll get to the point when we may feel machines know our emotions better than we do. I'm not sure that's a good thing.
I agree. I mean, algorithms, the more that we think about how preferences are now controlling our lives, we've gotten used to, say, GPS, you know, a lot of times determining where we drive. That same type of logic could come into play, like I mentioned, on a date. You know, you start to know what someone's going to say before they say it.
Well, you refer to the theory of the Eliza effect. What was the original experiment there?
I think that was in the 60s, and it was named after Eliza Doolittle. And it's a fascinating experiment and sort of an anthropomorphizing of technology. People were put into an experimental room where they talked to a computer, and the computer responded. This is in the 60s, so the voice was not even like Siri level. but people started to think that it was a real person. And that's the same thing that happens a lot of times. We get closer to technology than we do to other people.
And that's what happens in the new movie Her.
Yeah. That's a great movie in terms of starting to think about. I'm doing an article for Mashable, and I found some research that said, I think HuffPo did it, that of 3,500 women surveyed in this one survey, 48% of them would rather not have sex for a month than go without their smartphone.
Okay. are we paying more for services like Facebook with our data because we're not paying for them with money?
Yes.
I mean, supposedly they're selling advertising, but it's my sense that what they're really selling is the data that we provide to them willingly.
They are. I mean, it's just easier to say they are. And Facebook's a great service. I've used it. I can tell you all the great things about it, and there's negative things about it. The problem that I have with Facebook is the precedents they've set up in terms of privacy. You know, when they went to the Hill, they had to talk again about facial recognition, why it was opt-out versus opt-in. That means that when people say, like, well, I'm not on Facebook, I don't have to worry about this stuff, I remind them, I think it's 45 million people or so, have their pictures tagged on Facebook, and they don't necessarily even have a phone with a camera, right? That's the type of setup where it's not that Facebook is evil, but they've set up a framework where all this stuff can happen and it's not controlled.
Well, one day I discovered that I had a Wikipedia entry. It was done against, you know, without consulting me. It was filled with misinformation. But there it is with an old picture of me that looks like some other guy.
Well, I'm sorry about the misinformation. That's kind of a compliment, though. Even with that, that means, you know, you've arrived.
But should we pay for these services with money instead if we could gain more control of them?
I'd pay for it in a heartbeat. And this group I mentioned, Respect Network, I think they're going to charge $25 a year for you to have this data vault. Remember, it's not just about the data that you're selling or exchanging. The insights about when those things transact, you also get to own.
You founded something called the Happathon Project. What's the mission of your organization?
Our tagline is connecting happiness to action, and we do values survey, and we're using these mobile phone tools when it's protected data to help people find volunteer opportunities to increase their happiness.
And you've created a fictional country called Eudaimonia?
Yes, and good pronunciation. It's the Greek word for long-term intrinsic well-being, so that was the fun part of coming up with that name.
How has it helped you develop strategies for use in the real world?
Well, I think a lot of people don't connect economics, as I didn't until 2 years ago when I got into writing this book and founding the nonprofit, that economics is about a value assessment. It's a philosophy. The GDP started after the Second World War when the world lay in ruins. So building up, you know, growth made sense. But to not measure things like the quality of the environment, these finite resources, simply doesn't make sense. So what we do in these workshops is essentially play a game that's interactive, and people can start seeing that if they value these multiple metrics about a country, that's the macro, the micro is in their lives.
John C. Havens is a contributing writer for Mashable, The Guardian, and The Huffington Post, founder of the Happathon Project, which is a nonprofit organization that connects happiness to action, one phone, one heart, one city at a time, they say. His book is called Hacking Happiness, Why Your Personal Data Counts and How Tracking It Can Change the World. It's published by Tarcha Penguin. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Leonard, my pleasure.